Hey everybody, this is James Wilson with MTB Strength Training Systems and BikeJames.com, and welcome to a special podcast. This is my MTB Performance Training Overview. Basically, I realized that in order to really understand kind of where I'm coming from with strength training and cardio training and just kind of performance training in general for mountain biking, that people were having to, go to a bunch of different sources and read different articles and listen to different podcasts to kind of get a, a basic idea of things. And so I decided to sit down and do a podcast that kind of summarizes everything in one place, basically where I'm at, right now with my ideas on performance training for our sport. And so this is basically going off of an outline for a seminar that I did a couple of weeks back. And so, like I said, it's basically just going to, once you listen to this podcast, if you've been following me for a while, then some of this will be a review, some new stuff thrown in. But there's a lot of people that, have started picking up on my stuff here over the last few months. And so this will just give everybody a chance to get up to speed with exactly, why I take the approach that I do and stuff like that. And so that's basically it. So I'm going to jump right into it. And the most important thing, I guess, really for you to understand is to really, embrace where I'm coming from and get the most out of my training programs, you have to make a paradigm shift with how you look at training. And the first thing that I want to go over is my MTB performance training wheel, or MTB performance wheel. And I've got a PDF file with this podcast on my blog at bikejames.com that you can download and look at this. But basically, this goes over the MTB performance wheel. The idea is there are 9 components that go into how you perform on your bike. And, just real quick, in no particular order, things like strength, mobility, cardio endurance, your mindset and mental approach, your bike and equipment, your ability to produce power, your nutrition and supplements, how well you recover from your training, and also your technical skills on your bike. And obviously, you can break each one of those down into other subsets and things like that, but that's just kind of a basic overview of the 9 things that go into how you perform on your bike. And the idea behind the performance wheel is that there's more to performance on the trail than just cardio or bike setup or even technical skill. Things like mobility and recovery and strength will impact how you perform on the trail. And the only way to true your performance wheel is to get it as strong as possible is to work on the loosest spoke. And, as mountain bikers, we know this better than most people. When you've got a wheel that's out of true, you don't just start cranking down on random spokes. You check your spokes and see which one is the loosest. You tighten it up, and then you check the spokes again and see how that affected the other spokes. And then you just continue tightening what presents itself as the loosest spoke until you've got a nice, true, strong wheel. However, that's not the approach that we take with training. And people tend to just keep cranking down on the same spokes over and over and over again. Whenever they're looking to get more performance on the trail, they just keep cranking down on the same ones. And usually, that is our cardio, which is, going out on training rides, just riding in general kind of falls under that category, doing intervals and cardio based workouts and stuff like that, trying to get that VO2 max higher. And also, bike and equipment, that's another thing that people usually fall back on. They try to buy performance, if they feel like they're lagging on the trail, then they need a lighter bike, or they need a better fork, or they need better tires or something like that. And so, those are the 2 spokes that people usually pay the most attention to, and usually stuff like, technical skills, mindset, strength and mobility, even nutrition and supplements, kind of get put on the back burner or even ignored outright. And so, but that's not the best way to go about trying to increase your performance, and also understanding that everything's related. You can't have an increase or a decrease in one area without it also affecting your other areas. And I was talking with a rider the other day about this. You know, he was asking me if he should do more cardio training. And, you know, I was telling him that, well, if you do more, you know, he was wanting to know if he should go on another trail ride, basically, to supplement his training and act as some additional cardio. And I was pointing out that, you know, the reality is when you are pedaling your bike, that tightens your hips. There's no getting around that. And, you know, most mountain bikers have notoriously tight hips. Their quads and hip flexors are very tight. Their hamstrings and glutes are long and weak. And things are just all out of whack. And so if you're going to add another day of cardio training in, well, you also have to add in extra recovery and mobility in order to offset that, you know, that additional cardio training and stuff like that. And so, you know, just understanding that everything is related. You know, again, if you add in strength training, you're probably going to have to cut back in some other areas. Like, you can't, you know, be doing a bunch of cardio training and then add in strength training on top of it and do absolutely nothing to increase your recovery and think that things are going to work out. You either need to get real aggressive with your recovery tactics as well, like getting extra sleep, or you need to cut back a little bit on your cardio training in order to not burn yourself out. And so, you know, but also understand that as you get stronger, that's going to affect your ability to produce power. That's going to affect, you know, your ability to use your cardio more efficiently. That's going to also affect your mindset. You're going to be more confident. So everything is interrelated, and you know, you can't just, you know, look for a strength program and a cardio program and just kind of do what I call Frankenstein's monster training, where you're getting all these different components from different coaches and different things. You know, people are doing, you know, strength training programs that they got off of, you know, bodybuilding.com, and then they're doing the cardio workout that they, you know, got recommended on mtbr.com, and, you know, and they're trying to like cobble these things together and not understanding that everything is interrelated. And so that's kind of the point behind the MTB performance wheel. And again, you really kind of have to embrace that concept to understand where I'm coming from with performance. You know, our idea is not to have the highest VO2 max. Our idea is to be the best on the trail that we can be. You know, and if having a higher VO2 max is going to help you do that, then great. But if that's not what you need some, you know, additional power, you need some additional technical skills, then just continuing to hammer on cardio is not going to make you necessarily a much better rider. And that's, we're missing the point of performance training. And so, you know, got to remember, you're training with an end goal in mind. So that's the MTB performance wheel. And then obviously within that, there are some areas that I'm, you know, I deal with a little bit more, things like strength, mobility, cardio, you know, power, nutrition, supplements, recovery. So there are some things like technical skills, you know, even though I do talk about that and how strength training stuff relates to that, there are people that are much better at coaching technical skills and going over stuff like that. I had to take a little pause there for a little emergency. My little girl came in and needed something there, so I have to excuse me as I get my train of thought back on track. But I was talking about technical skills and how, you know, there's, you know, definitely people who are better than me at talking about that, things like mindset, bike and equipment setup. So I'm not going to necessarily get into those things. Those are a little bit beyond my realm of expertise. But, you know, specifically when we're talking about strength and conditioning, which, you know, the big three are four really, is strength, power, mobility, and cardio. Those are kind of the things that really fall under my realm of expertise. And so those are the things that I'm going to be addressing and talking about how they relate to mountain biking. And even within that, we've got something that I call it's called the Optimum Performance Pyramid. And again, I've got a PDF file that you can download with this podcast and take a look at that. And this is something that was popularized by Gray Cook. And basically it looks at how you safely and most effectively develop a sport-specific skill and understanding, you know, kind of how these things interrelate. And when you're looking at this, it is a pyramid. The base level is the, you know, the widest, the biggest level, and that's functional movement. And on the PDF file, I have some examples. Things like being able to touch your toes, you know, that's pretty basic functional movement. If you can't touch your toes, then you've got some serious mobility issues, and you know, every movement that you create is through some sort of compensation that's going to lead to some sort of breakdown. You know, being able to keep your shoulders pulled down and back. I mean, there's a lot of mountain bikers that literally cannot get their shoulders down and back. They're in just such a forward slope position that they can't get them down and back. You know, being able to keep solid foot contact with the ground when executing exercise is not, you know, especially when you're doing lower body exercises, not coming up on your toe and having your weight shift forward, being able to keep, you know, your weight distributed evenly on your foot, you know, a little bit back on your heel evenly. You know, being able to execute an overhead squat with a PVC pipe, just a basic body weight overhead squat, you know, being able to execute a simple movement like that. Those are examples of functional movement. And this is like the alignment on your car. You know, if the alignment's out of whack and you just keep trying to drop a bigger engine in your car, then, you know, you're eventually, something is going to break down. You're going to get to the point to where, you know, you can't put any more horsepower in the car because you're not going to be able to handle it anymore. It's just going to, you know, the alignment's so out of whack. Things are just going to get so crazy when you start hammering. So that's what basically where functional movement kind of falls in. And again, you ignore these things at your own peril. I mean, I had a guy come in and do a movement screen with me actually yesterday. And, you know, a rider, most people consider him to be pretty fit. And, you know, he knows, as I start taking him through the functional movement screen, we do the active leg raise, and he tells me, oh, yeah, you know, my hamstrings are tight. And sure enough, you know, he got a 1, which means he, you know, he's got some serious issues with his ability to create a bend at his hips. And, you know, and he knows this, yet he continues to just ride his bike. He doesn't spend the amount of time that he needs with mobility and core strength in order to get that where it needs to be. So, and again, this is kind of one of those things where having a coach, having somebody to tell you what to do so that you don't just do what you want to do, what you enjoy doing all the time, comes in handy, because every once in a while you need somebody to say, look, you don't need to go on another bike ride. You need to stay home and do some foam roller work, do these mobility drills, and work on your core strength, because you're a walking injury time bomb waiting to happen with these huge deficits in your functional movement. So the next level on top of functional movement is functional strength, and this is basically your ability to apply force with that high quality movement. So again, you know, you may be able to let's say you can deadlift a lot of weight, but if your functional movement isn't good and you're having to round your lower back when you're bending down to pick up the bar, and you're using more of your quads and your lower back to pick the bar up, that's not functional strength. That's gym strength. Functional strength is you being able to execute these basic movement patterns that you need in everyday life and on your bike, and then being able to apply force through those and maintain that good functional movement. So, you know, some examples of this are being able to do 10 strict push-ups. And, you know, you would be absolutely surprised how many people cannot do 10 strict push-ups. And I emphasize strict because, again, most people will say, oh, I can do 20, 25 push-ups. And I guarantee you that they can't do 20 to 25 real push-ups where they're, you know, coming all the way down to the ground, keeping their back perfectly straight. They're not doing the little inchworm thing up. You know, being able to do 6 strict chin-ups, again, where you're coming all the way down while your arms are straight at the bottom, not the little three-quarter chin-ups that people like to do. 5 single-leg squats. That's a real important one for mountain bikers. So, again, you know, your functional strength is extremely important because, again, this is like adding horsepower to the car. And so the more horsepower that you have, the faster that you can go. But again, you got to make sure that you have your alignment good so that you're not just going to blow yourself up in the process. And then on the very top of the pyramid, you have your sport specific skills and training. And this is stuff like technical skills training, training rides, you know, things that we would think of as more mountain bike specific training. But again, you're not going to get as much out of this type of training if your functional movement and your functional strength sucks. And, you know, for example, I've done a skills camp with Gene Hamilton, who does the Better Ride camps, and they're, you know, great camps. Definitely recommend them. But, you know, I saw people, one of the gentlemen in my camp literally did not know how to get into the attack position on the bike. Like, it's basically the bottom of the deadlift where you're able to shift your hips back behind your heels, keeping your back straight, letting your chest come down to the ground. That's the basic functional movement that you need to get into your attack position on your bike. And he just didn't really understand how to accomplish that basic movement, and instead was, you know, rounding his lower back and dropping his butt straight down. And, you know, so he spent the rest of the camp learning how to apply skills to a bad position. So again, you're not going to get as much out of skills training if you don't have basic functional movement. And your functional strength is going to allow you to hold that functional movement better, you know, during the execution of skills and stuff like that. And so that's kind of an example of how this stuff works. You know, you need technical skills training, but I'm not going to say you're wasting your time, but you're definitely not getting as much out of it if you go to a technical skills training camp and you can't even touch your toes. Okay, so you need to take these things in order and understand how each one builds on top of the next one, and you know, results in a good, just a good overall injury-resistant athlete and mountain biker. And so, you know, again, I made a couple notes on the bottom of this PDF. You know, and you know, sport-specific skills and training—they are the pinnacle of the pyramid, and they are the most important force. People get confused when they hear me talk about this because they think that I'm saying that, you know, the most important thing is, you know, stretching, or the most important thing is strength training. And, well, it is if that's where your deficit is, but that's not the most important thing for a mountain biker. The point is you want to get those things, you know, functional movement and functional strength built up to the point that you can work on the most important components for you as a mountain biker. So you just have to understand that they are critical to your long-term success. You want to train the person first and the athlete second. You got to remember that you're a human being that mountain bikes. You're not a mountain biker that also happens to be a human being. And so that's why, you know, understanding like why being able to touch your toes is going to help you ride your bike better, because you're a person first. And if you can't move freely and execute basic human movements, then the more specific movements that you're looking to create on your bike are not going to happen as efficiently. So, you know, even if some of this stuff doesn't apply directly to mountain biking, it's still important for you to do just to keep yourself well-rounded as a person and an athlete, and that's going to improve your ability to, you know, be a better mountain biker. And then, you know, being strong and knowing how to apply that strength in a sport-specific manner is a skill, and it's got to be taught just like any other skill would be. And so, you know, that's why taking things in this stepped approach, just, you know, being able to execute a bodyweight squat before we start loading that squat. But then understanding that once you start loading that squat, we're still looking for you to maintain the same body position and execution as we got with the body weight squat. And so just because you've got weight doesn't mean that things can start falling apart. And so just understanding that that's what we're looking for overall with a performance training program. So that's kind of the paradigm shift, if you will, that you kind of have in order to really understand where I'm coming from with training. You know, when people ask me, should I do more cardio? You know, realistically, I don't know until I, you know, get a little bit more information. I need to know, where's your mobility at? Where's your strength levels at? What do you feel is holding you back on the trail? You know, stuff like that. So, you know, you can't just, you know, randomly go out and start doing things, you know, different training things, and think that that's going to lead to the best performance on the trail. You have to understand everything's related, and how they relate, and you know, kind of how to build on one thing to the next. So so that's basically it with that. So I'm going to get into a couple things in particular here, and the first thing that I'm going to talk about is why mobility and functional movement is so important. And again, just kind of relating these things to the optimum performance pyramid. You've got bad movement versus good movement. And whether you're aware of it or not, it doesn't matter. But whenever you're moving around, you're on your bike, you're in the gym, just everyday life, you're either creating good movement or bad movement. Good movement is where you are stabilizing in the right areas and moving in the right areas. And bad movement is obviously where that is not happening, where you're, you know, stabilizing with the wrong muscles and you're moving from the wrong areas. And so a good example of this is your ability to create like a deadlift type movement. If you don't have good hip mobility and good core strength, then you're going to end up bending at the lower back at the lumbar spine in order to get down rather than keeping the lower back and lumbar spine straight and bending at the hips. And so, you know, if you're using good movement, then we're strengthening a movement pattern. We're practicing that good movement that we need on our bike. If you're using bad movement, you're setting yourself up for an injury down the road. You know, low back soreness and low back injuries are a huge thing. I think I read at one point like 80% of, you know, Americans are going to suffer from low back pain at some point in their life. And so, you know, making sure that you understand how to keep that low back safe and stable and move from the right areas is huge. On you know, more levels than one. So now a huge portion of functional movement is mobility, and there's actually three components to mobility. And the first is tissue quality, and this is basically where massage, foam rolling, things like that come in. If you've got a tight muscle that has a lot of knots and adhesions and excessive tension, then you're not going to be able to get it to move freely. You know, imagine you've got a rubber band and you stretch the rubber band and you get it to lengthen, and which is kind of, you know, basically a good analogy to what happens when we're doing static stretching. Now take that rubber band and tie a knot in it and stretch it again, and what's going to happen? That knot's going to get tighter and the rubber band's not going to stretch as far. And so that's kind of the same idea as what happens, is what we want to do with our muscles. We want to address those knots and adhesions in the muscle before we start, you know, trying to stretch the muscle out. And so that's, you know, the first part is tissue quality. The second part is tissue length. And so this is where stretching comes into play. And static stretching, despite, you know, the mixed press that it's gotten over the last few years, is a very important and vital component to strength training. And in fact, there are times when you want to do static stretching before you do strength training and riding. If you have a muscle that's short and tight, and like, for example, if you've got short and tight hip flexors and that's interfering with your hip function, well, getting that muscle to lengthen and relax before you start doing strength training and you know, or riding or something like that is actually going to result in improved hip function and give you more strength and power. So this whole idea that you should never static stretch before strength training is completely oversimplified. You know, there you definitely don't need to stretch everything out, but there are some key areas that you would want to stretch out. So tissue length is definitely a huge part of that, and static stretching is definitely very important for us as mountain bikers. And then the last component is your motor control of that range of motion. And this is where, you know, if you're familiar with the term dynamic mobility, this is where this comes in. And so, again, if you've gotten the tissue quality improved, you've lowered the muscle tension levels, and then you've used static stretching to lengthen the tissue, well, now you have to practice taking your joints through that full range of motion and getting your nervous system used to creating tension and controlling that new range of motion that hopefully you have you know, gotten from the previous two things there. So as you can see, getting mobility is not just as simple as doing some stretching or, you know, just doing dynamic mobility or just doing foam rolling or getting massage. You need to use all three of those things in order to develop true mobility and just your ability to move freely. And that's huge. That's the basis for everything. If you can't move freely, if you don't have good mobility, then everything else that you're doing is going to, it's not going to be as effective as it could or should be. And more importantly, you're going to actually be breaking yourself down in the wrong areas and setting yourself up for an injury down the road. And so, you know, most of the, I just did a blog post on this recently on the pain, pain injury surgery cycle. And, you know, basically most of the stuff that happens to us are these repetitive use injuries that could completely be avoided if we took a better approach, especially watched our mobility and how we're creating movements. But unless you know, got into a traumatic accident, you know, fell off your bike and broke your arm or had something, you know, very acute like that happen, the injury more than likely could have been avoided. That knee injury that started as a little niggle and then got, you know, a little more painful, and then eventually you had to go get some PT, and the next thing you know, you've got to go get it cleaned out. That is completely avoidable if you are you know, using these strategies to, you know, keep your functional movement and stuff good. So, you know, another part of this functional, you know, mobility and functional movement is understanding the human body can only create 7 basic movements. You know, we can bend. And again, when most people think bend over, they're thinking about bending from the lower back. We're told, like, don't bend over. You're supposed to be able to bend. You're supposed to be able to bend from the hips at the hip joint while keeping the low back strong and stable. And this relates to our deadlift position, which also relates to our attack position on the bike and stuff. And so it's actually a really important movement for mountain bikers to have. You can push, you can pull, you can squat, basically change your center of gravity up and down. You can lunge. You can rotate or actually resist. Resisting rotation actually falls under this category as well. And you can, you know, what's called gait, you know, movement, move in space. That's it. Those are the 7 things that your body can do. Everything else, every other movement is basically a combination of those 7 things. And so, you know, obviously, if you've been following my stuff, you know, I'm a huge fan of Gray Cook and his functional movement screen. And the idea is you have to look at your movement chain. You have to look at these basic movements and understand where are you the weakest. Because, again, the only way to strengthen your weakest link, to strengthen a chain is to strengthen the weakest link. And so, you know, if you are really weak with your bending, like your deadlift strength just sucks, but you continue to just, you know, train bench press and chin-ups and doing some squatting and stuff like that and just totally ignoring that bending movement, then you're missing the point. You're not developing a good, strong, functional, injury-resistant body. And again, eventually you're going to be held back. Your performance levels are going to be held back by that deficit. So just understanding like what mobility and what functional movement has to do with supporting our higher levels of training is huge. And so again, moving up a level, why strength training is important for increased performance and skills. And again, I'm a huge proponent for strength training and trying to help mountain bikers understand how this is going to increase your endurance on the bike and how it's going to actually increase your technical skills. And I kind of touched on this earlier with the example of why doing skills training while not being able to touch your toes isn't going to work as well. But when you understand how basic skills that you need on your bike, things like the attack position, things like bunny hopping and jumping, things like cornering, standing, pedaling, climbing, you know, these skills that you need on the trail, there are movements behind those skills, and you can use strength and conditioning to improve the quality of that movement and strengthen that movement, and then that is going to result in better technical skills on your bike. And so, you know, that's a huge one. And so, you know, overall, like this is an example I've used a couple times, but you know, strength is extremely important for our sport, and more important than I think a lot of people realize. And you know, here's a good example and very simple question: why are the men so much faster than the women? You know, it's not a matter of technical skills. It's not a matter of, you know, willingness to put in training time and stuff like that. A lot of time it's not, you know, necessarily a matter of VO2 max. You know, there's definitely women that test out at the same level or even higher than some of the men, and yet they can't, you know, the performance gap between the men, the top men and the top women is pretty big. What is the big factor there? The factor is strength. Men are simply stronger than women. Everything that they do, they can apply more power to. And so if you can take two riders that have similar technical skills, you know, similar cardio capacity, and yet they can be decisively separated by strength levels, then you start to understand why strength is so important for mountain biking. And, you know, if you don't have to have the biggest cardio capacity, if you've got a huge strength advantage and you know, also your technical skills, I think like cardio gets way overplayed in mountain biking, and people completely forget about how important strength and technical skills are in the overall scheme of things, and And so, but anyway, so that just kind of helps you understand that strength is extremely important. And, you know, exercises, they allow us to correct and to master key movement skills that we need on the bike. And so this is another reason why strength training is so important, because, you know, imagine like a mixed martial artist, like a cage fighter. You know, they don't just fight, get in the cage and fight. They practice their skills at a low level, basically repetitively, over and over and over in a practice situation, getting them ingrained so that when they get in the cage and they are in a hairball situation, they're just instinctive. They just go right to them. They know how to execute these skills. And that's the same thing that strength training provides us. Good luck trying to figure out how to master your attack position and cornering on the trail. Okay, it's not going to happen. In fact, this is one of the things that guys like Lee McCormick and Gene Hamilton, you know, the two skills guys that I go to when I have questions and stuff, talk about. That, you know, the best in the world don't become the best by only riding. You know, that they're riding like, you know, simpler trails where they're able to really concentrate on their technical skills, getting out in the parking lot and doing a figure eight drill around cones to practice your cornering, you know, things like that, getting out in an open field and practicing your track stands and basic things like that. That is what's going to help you out on the trail, but also getting in the gym and understanding that you can practice these movement skills, understanding how the swing relates to jumping, how the deadlift relates to the attack position on the bike, how you know, some movements, some exercises like the windmill and the Saxon side bend and stuff like that relate to the hip shift that you need to get down in order to understand how to corner. So, you know, when you understand how these exercises relate and you're in the gym and you're doing these exercises and you're actively thinking about how they're relating to the trail, now you're training. Now you're not just going through a list of exercises and going through a workout, you know, just trying to build some random fitness. You're actually training with a purpose. And so that's what we want to try to accomplish with our workouts there. And so the a good thing for us to keep in mind. Another thing that we want to keep in mind with strength training is that getting strong will make good movement more permanent, especially in the face of fatigue. And this is, again, where how being strong will actually help increase your endurance, will help supplement your cardio. Like, the less efficient your movement is, the more energy you're having to put out in order to accomplish the same thing. And so, again, it goes back to that alignment on your car. If the alignment on your car is out of whack, you're going to need more horsepower in order to go the same speed as a car that has perfect alignment but a little less horsepower. And so, you know, you're sitting there guzzling gas, you're using up your cardio capacity because of inefficient movement. Like, as you fatigue and you start, you know, using the lower back more, and you're not keeping your core strong, and you're using more knee extension and less hip extension and stuff like that, you're starting to, like, your miles per gallon basically just starts to plummet. And so when you get strong with a movement, it's more ingrained, it's more permanent, and as you fatigue, you're going to be far more likely to stick with that high-quality movement. Your body just knows that, and it's going to stay with that. And so you're going to continue to get more miles per gallon, if you will, out of your cardio capacity as you get deeper into a race or ride and you start to fatigue. So, you know, that's a huge part of why strength training is going to help you as a mountain biker, because, you know, everybody's good the first few minutes of a ride. You know, it's as we fatigue where things start to go downhill. Like, most people, when they get hurt, you know, they crash, it's not at the beginning of the ride. You know, sometimes it is and we're just goofing around, but a lot of times it's as we're tired, as we fatigue, as we're unable to hold ourselves in a good, strong position. And so, again, cardio, you know, increasing your cardio is not necessarily going to train your body how to be strong and maintain those key movement patterns as you get fatigued. And so you need to understand how the two interrelate together. My top three exercises, and this is another thing, just trying to help people understand how strength training relates to riding. And there are, you know, three exercises that I think that, you know, every mountain biker should be doing and incorporating on some level. The first one is the deadlift, or more importantly, the single leg deadlift. Again, this is your attack position. This is the core strength and leg drive that you need for standing pedaling. And that's a huge one. This is actually something I've been talking with a buddy of mine about. You know, this whole idea that seated pedaling is more efficient than standing pedaling. You know, it's not necessarily more efficient as much as it is. It doesn't require the same core strength and upper body strength that that seated pedaling does. And so when you get strong on the deadlift, you're getting that core and upper body strength stronger so that when you're standing, you can, you know, support more of your weight with your core and upper body and not be supporting as much with the legs. And so you're able to drive, you know, harder and longer from a standing position. And that is the faster position. You know, guys like, you know, one of my clients, Ross Schnell, is one of the top XC riders in the world. He's actually the current single speed world champion. You know, he doesn't have a granny gear on his bike. He rocks the trails with a, you know, 34, 36 tooth chainring. And I guarantee you he ain't sitting and spinning circles going up some of them steep hills. He's standing and hammering. So, you know, if the top guys in the world understand that the fastest way up a hill is to stand and hammer, then what you want to do is make sure that you're doing things to really get strong with that position and that movement. And so the deadlift is key for that. So that's a huge one for us. The next one is the swing. And the swing is basically kind of a dynamic deadlift. And this is really important for understanding how to use the hip pop, as I call it, for bunny hopping and popping off of a lip. And, you know, again, I know not everybody listening to this has dreams of, you know, catching huge air and stuff like that. But, you know, it's still a component of mountain biking. Being able to bunny hop up a ledge at speed, you know, when you're going along the trail and you got like a 2-foot ledge coming up in front of you, instead of having to stop, practically come to a stop so that you can, you know, lift your front wheel up onto it and then lift your rear wheel onto it, if you're able to maintain your speed and bunny hop up onto the ledge, then you're going to, you know, obviously you're not going to have to expend as much energy getting back up to speed. You're going to keep your flow. So again, this is one of those things that will kind of tie into your overall performance and endurance on the trail. And so it's, you know, important. And one of the things that really messes people up is not understanding how to throw those hips forward to create the pop that we're looking for. And it's not just leaning back into the movement. You know, a lot of people just kind of use their lower back and lean back and then don't really know what to do from there. Or worse yet, they, you know, just use their clipless pedals or clipped under the pedals and they just kind of pull up everything on their bike. And again, that'll work on some level, but you're eventually going to be limited with how, you know, effectively you can jump and bunny hop with that approach there. And so learning the swing is really going to help you accomplish that. And then last but not least is an exercise called the side press. And this is basically like a single arm shoulder press where you also lean to the side as you're pressing the weight up. And this is a really good one because, again, it teaches us the hip motion that we need for cornering. And cornering is again, it's a huge one. You know, understanding how to lean your bike and use your hips to counterbalance your lean. And, you know, the better that you can corner, the more efficient you're going to be on the trail, the less energy you're going to have to expend getting back up to speed, coming out of corners and stuff like that. And so understanding that hip motion is extremely important, getting that lateral hip motion. But it's also really important because this movement is great for building shoulder mobility and stability, which is a big one. Again, that upper back and the shoulders are such a weak point for most mountain bikers. They're very injury prone. And so building their stability and mobility is huge. And also just building that lateral core strength. Again, that's a big weakness for a lot of mountain bikers. And, you know, this ties into being able to stomp on the pedals and lay power down without having your hips shift around a lot and losing some of that power in the hip shift. And so those are kind of my top three exercises and how they relate to the trail and why you want to be concentrating on them and using them as part of your program. So that kind of covers what we're looking for from strength training and stuff like that, why it's important, and some, you know, exercises for you to, you know, look at incorporating in your program, and how they relate to the trail. So now I want to get into cardio training, and this is probably, you know, I got to admit, when I first got into created MTB strength training systems, I really had no intention into getting into cardio training. I figured that there would be other people out there that I could refer riders to, but I started to realize that there's not, you know, the idea of using interval training and not using aerobic base training for your average mountain biker, it's not something that's really well known and well used in mountain biking circles. And so it's kind of funny because, man, when I first came out and started saying, like, you don't need to do aerobic base training in order to increase your cardio, and especially, you know, downhillers and four cross riders, I mean, I still cannot, I can understand because it's tradition, but, you know, just based, I mean, this is not new science, you know, this stuff has been out for a while now, but the idea that we've still got professional downhill riders out on a road bike for, you know, an hour and a half to 2 hour, you know, base training ride, just blows my mind. You know, it just makes no sense in the face of what we understand about the human body now. But when I first came out and started saying this stuff, I was, you know, you'd think I was saying bad stuff about people's mothers. I mean, people got really offended by it. But it's funny because somebody just, clued me in on a book that Chris Carmichael came out with, and, you know, Chris Carmichael is Lance Armstrong's cycling coach, and you know, as you probably know, I'm not the hugest fan of looking at road cycling training tactics and just blindly applying them to mountain biking, but he was telling me that this new book called the, you know, Training Programs for Time Crunch Cyclists, and it's basically, if you've got less than 5 hours a week to train, then you want to be concentrating on interval training. I was like, wow, you know, sounds like something I've been saying. So if you've got very limited training time, then aerobic base training is a complete waste of that time. And now even, you know, one of the top road cycling coaches has come out and said this as well. So again, this is not stuff that I make up. But when we're talking about cardio training and increasing cardio capacity, you know, I do this a lot. Like, I question why. Why do we do stuff, you know? And my idea is that if you're able to, if you come to the same answer, then that just reinforces what you were doing in the first place. But sometimes it really makes you, you know, you're like, well, I don't know, now that I really kind of think about it logically. You know, what is the point of aerobic based training? What was the point of doing these long, slow rides early in the off season? It was to build, you know, VO2 max and, you know, aerobic endurance. Well, the science says that the fastest way to build VO2 max and aerobic endurance is not through aerobic training, it's through interval training. I mean, again, the science is pretty solid behind this, showing that you can get the same or even better results in a fraction of the time by doing interval training. In fact, one of the studies looked at, I think it was 1 hour, like three 20-minute interval sessions versus like 4 to 5 hours of, you know, traditional aerobic you know, base training, like just, you know, an hour plus at a steady state. And at the end of the study, they showed the exact same increases in VO2 max. So you've got 1 hour a week versus 4 to 5 hours a week, you get the exact same increases in VO2 max. And the interval training group also showed, obviously, increases in anaerobic cardio capacity that the aerobic training group didn't. So they actually got better overall cardio results in 1 hour a week versus 4 to 5 hours a week. So, again, you know, that's the point of aerobic base training was to build the mitochondrial density, increase VO2 max, basically do these things that were going to support higher level training down the road. But we now understand that these same physiological adaptations take place with interval training, and they happen a lot quicker and with a lot less training time. So, especially, you know, if you're an average rider and you're not a pro who's got, you know, 4 hours a day to train, this is another thing. You know, if you tell me you got 4 hours a day to train, versus 4 hours a week to train, then, you know, my advice would probably be a little bit different. But, you know, most riders are looking more like 4 to 5 hours a week to train. And so if that's the case, then you need to be concentrating on interval training and also understanding, like, what are the real effects of aerobic training, of this long, slow, steady state cardio. The reality is that you come out of a steady state cardio phase a weaker, slower, smaller athlete. And, you know, that's not necessarily what most of us are looking for. And again, you know, people love to go to the extremes. Oh, what about these, you know, guys riding the Leadville 100, you know? Well, great. If you're one of those people, which is like a small percentage handful of these ultra endurance riders, then yes, obviously, from a specificity standpoint, you need to be doing some longer, slow rides. Although interval training is still going to help immensely. But most people aren't like that, okay? I mean, let's just be completely honest. Most of us are talking about getting out for an epic ride of like 4 or 5 hours, you know, once or twice a month. You know, most of our rides are more in like the hour to 2 hour range, you know, a couple times a week. So, you know, let's not get like, you know, start talking, getting too worried about the extremes there of the curve. But the real effects, again, you know, a weaker athlete, and this happens because you have muscle fibers, you have fast twitch and slow twitch, with which most people are familiar with, but you also have what are known as intermediary fibers, and they're fibers that take on the characteristics of what you do and how you train. So if you train long and slow, they're going to take on the characteristics of, you know, slower, weaker, more endurance-based fibers. If you train hard and fast and use strength training, they're going to take on the characteristics of the fast-twitch muscle fibers. So, you know, especially if you're a downhill, a four-cross rider, a super D rider, you know, any type of rider that relies on strength and power as a huge component of your success, then you want to be doing everything that you can to get those fibers to shift towards the strength and power end of the spectrum and keep them there. You do not want to encourage them to start acting like slow twitch muscle fibers. So, you know, again, that's just a reality. This is a well-documented thing that happens with aerobic training. Another thing that happens is muscle wasting. Aerobic training is very catabolic. It releases cortisol, which is going to burn muscle tissue. So you will lose muscle tissue. And the other thing is that it does improve fat burning efficiency, which is not necessarily the best thing. You know, if you're an athlete that relies on your ATP, CP, and glycolytic pathways, again, just getting a little into, you know, physiology there, then trying to get your body to be as efficient at burning fat as possible isn't necessarily what you want. And especially for those of you who are looking to lose a couple extra pounds, you know, basically a more efficient fat burning machine means that you're going to burn less fat for the same amount of effort, which is not what you want. And so, again, these are physiological adaptations to aerobic training that are, you know, they're not really up for debate. I mean, these are things that happen. And so, again, if your goal is to be as you know, strong and as powerful as possible to maintain muscle tissue and to, you know, be anaerobically efficient, then you want to avoid aerobic training, you know, pretty much across the board. You know, you don't want to necessarily go out for an hour aerobic training ride. You know, like I said, working with Aaron Gwynn, you know, a lot of people know who he is now. He's been racing for 2 years, like literally 2 years, a professional mountain biker. Got 10th place in his first World Cup at Mount St. Anne, current American downhill champ, you know, third place last year at Mount St. Anne. I think he got on, you know, 3 podiums. First American to stand on a podium at a World Cup event in like 5 or 6 years. Just so I have been working with him since he started racing. He's not spent one aerobic-based training ride. I do not have him on a road bike. I don't have him doing any sort of steady-state cardio. And I don't believe that it's a coincidence that he concentrates on being strong and anaerobically fit, and he also happens to be the best American that's been produced in half a decade. So, anyways, you know, just kind of a little, you know, proof is in the pudding there for people that like to naysay, you know, what I'm saying here. And so, again, so that's kind of, you know, looking at why do we do aerobic-based training? you know, and it's not necessarily even the most efficient way to accomplish what we're trying to accomplish with aerobic-based training, and then looking at the real effects of aerobic training and understanding, like, why you want to, you know, minimize and even avoid, you know, doing that. So again, something I had mentioned before was 4 hours a week versus 4 hours a day. And this is another thing that gets, you know, when people are looking at the training that pros do. Again, I, you know, working with guys like Aaron Gwynn and Ross Schnell, these guys are pros. They've got nothing to do but train. They literally have 4 hours a day to train, and then the rest of the day is spent eating and recovering and stuff like that and getting ready for their next training day. So you can't look at what they do unless you also are able to recreate that with your own life, which most people are not. And, you know, this is also another reason why, you know, these super fancy periodization schemes and stuff don't necessarily work for your average rider, because, again, you know, you don't know when the kids are going to be sick and you're going to have to miss a week of training. So, you know, if you've got this super specific, you know, program that you're trying to follow, again, like based on something that pro riders do, you know, you may not necessarily be able to follow it as well as they will. And so, again, the point is, you know, if you've got 4 hours a week to train versus 4 hours a day to train, you have to understand that. And you have to understand how you have to make shifts in your training approach based on that. And so intervals are what I call the big rocks of cardio training. And basically this comes from an analogy. If you've got a jar and you've got rocks and you've got you know, big rocks and you've got gravel and you've got sand and you've got water, and you're trying to fill that jar as full as possible with each one, you know, you'd have to start with the big rocks. You put as many big rocks in the jar as possible, and then you put as much gravel in the jar as possible, and then you put as much sand in the jar as possible, and then you can top it off with some water, and now you've got, you know, a full jar. If you did that backwards, if you started with the water and then you tried to put the sand in and then you try to put the little rocks in, by the time you got to the big rocks, you'd have no room for it. And so understanding that, you know, is there a place for, you know, longer steady state rides? You know, probably, but I would categorize them as like the sand or water of a cardio training program, not the big rocks. The big rocks are intervals. Those are the biggest bang for your buck thing that you can do to increase your cardio levels. And the two studies that really point this out are the Tabata study, and this is where we get what's commonly known as the Tabata protocol, the 20 seconds on, 10 seconds rest, repeating 8 times. And again, most people don't do this correctly anyways. Like, you can't have Tabata crunches. That's just the, you know, that you literally have to go as hard as you can. Like, a good analogy for this is, imagine you're, you know, on a train trestle on a bridge spanning a canyon, and you're halfway across and you hear the train coming, and you're not really sure that you're going to be able to make it to the other side before that train reaches you. You know how fast you would run? That is how fast, that is how hard you have to go on each interval of a Tabata interval, you know, to really get the benefits, you know, to recreate the study. But the point is the Tabata study showed some of the largest increases in VO2 max on record, any study ever done. And he was actually working with, you know, athletes. This wasn't, you know, done on, you know, sedentary people. And so, again, you know, intervals produced huge increases in VO2 max very quickly. Within a few weeks. The other one is the Jabala study, and that's the one that I mentioned earlier, where they were looking at 1 hour a week of intervals versus 4 to 5 hours a week of steady state cardio, and finding that the VO2 max increases were the same between the groups. And, you know, while the, you know, obviously the group that exercised for an hour spent much less time actually doing cardio training. So, you know, again, if you got 4 to 5 hours a week, you would be much better off doing an hour of intervals and then using that other time working on the other components of the performance wheel, doing some strength training, doing some mobility training, working on your technical skills. You're going to be a much better rider taking that approach than you will if you spend all of your training time doing cardio training and training rides and stuff like that. So, again, that's kind of the idea there. You know, another thing to keep in mind, and this is, you know, across the board, when I talk to riders, nobody tells me that they feel like they need to be able to spin the flats better. You know, that's just, that's never comes up. They feel like they need to be able to lay down, you know, more power later in a race. They need to be able to dominate climbs. They need to be able to hammer when they're trying to pass a rider. Like, those are the efforts that make them feel like they're going to blow up. But then you look at how they train, and they spend most of their training, you know, in heart rates and intensity zones and stuff like that that don't mimic what they're going to use in a race. And, you know, this saying that to be fierce on the trail, you must be fierce in training, you know, is basically kind of my take on some advice from one of my favorite training books, the Book of Five Rings, which is, you know, actually written by an old samurai on his approach to training. But, you know, he said to be fierce in battle, you must be fierce in training. That there's no that battle should just be an extension of how you train. And so, you know, same idea with your training for riding, that, you know, how you ride in a race, for those of you that race, should just be an extension of how you train. And so, you know, if you don't take yourself into that red zone and you don't work on that anaerobic endurance and that ability to repeatedly, you know, hammer down with hard efforts, what makes you think you're going to be able to do it when it comes race time? You know, it's not the person who put in the most base miles who's going to win. It's the person who can lay down the most power for the longest that's going to win. And so, again, that's where the intervals come in. Another thing to keep in mind with cardio training, and this is another thing that kind of catches me some flack from time to time, but, you know, the road bike is not necessarily your best training tool for cardio training. And you know, there's a specificity of movement, and people forget this, like, just because the two look similar, your nervous system looks at your position and movement creation on a road bike differently than it looks at your position and movement creation on a mountain bike. And again, just questioning why do mountain bikers ride a road bike? You know, it's faster. Well, why is it faster? It's faster because it's easier. You know, for the same, you know, you're able to get further for the same amount of effort because the bike is lighter and it's more, you know, you're in a more aerodynamic position. But is because something is easier necessarily a really good reason to use it as a training tool? You know, I certainly don't think so. I think that you're better off, you know, in the off season when you can't get out on the trail, throwing some slicks on your mountain bike and laying that cardio fitness on top of your specific movement pattern that you need for the trail. You know, again, that's like, you know, if you're you know, a warrior in ancient Japan and you use the long sword in battle, but you decide that you want to start practicing with the short sword. You know, yeah, there's some transfer there, but again, like, you know, when you put it that way, people are like, man, I'd practice with the weapon I use in battle. Well, okay, then why are you practicing with a different weapon than you use on the trail? You know, that just, again, it just, from a logical standpoint, some of the stuff doesn't make as much sense. There's a lot of tradition and stuff that once you question, you start realizing, like, man, I don't really know why we do some of this stuff. So, you know, again, the road bike is not the best training tool for you. Throw some slicks on your mountain bike. Get used to that position. You know, another thing, train your weakness, standing versus seated pedaling. Again, the way that your body creates and powers standing pedaling is totally different than the way that it creates and powers seated pedaling. So if you feel like, especially for you downhill and four cross riders, if you're sitting down, I don't really consider that to be training for your event. You need to be standing. Only standing pedaling efforts really count as your as training. And again, this is, you know, one of the most common complaints I hear is, as I get towards the end of the race, I feel like I want to sit down. Well, no crap. That's how you spend most of your training time. That's where your body's comfortable. You're strongest with seated pedaling because that's what you do the most of, and you wonder why when you fatigue, you want to sit down. You know, don't sit down. You know, it just some of these things just make me laugh when we look at them from just a logical standpoint. So, but again, if you're standing pedaling is your weakness, then train standing pedaling. You know, if seated pedaling is your weakness, then train that. But understand that the two are not the same, and that just, you know, doing one is not going to necessarily have as much transfer to the other, because the movements are created differently. And so, you know, again, you know, you want to make sure that you're training what you need in your race and what your weakness is. And so, you know, for most people, that is standing pedaling. So doing, when you're doing your intervals, standing up and doing them, don't sit down. Of course it's harder, but that's what you need to get stronger with. And so we need to attack those weaknesses. And so, so that's basically it on, you know, the cardio side of things. And, you know, how to quickly increase your cardio, concentrate on interval training, and understand that you want to, you know, attack your weakness. If it's seated pedaling, then use that. If it's standing pedaling, then use that. And that's going to get you the fastest cardio and the fastest transfer to the trail. Pretty simple stuff there. Couple more things. The strength, you know, using strength and conditioning to address injuries, this is huge. You know, in my mind, there's no difference in training to prevent injuries and training to increase performance, because the same things that are going to cause injuries are also going to hold back your performance. The bad movement is going to do both. And so, you know, one of the things that I'd recently brought up on my blog is something called the joint by joint approach to training. And this is something that was popularized by Mike Boyle. But basically understanding that certain joints want to be mobile and some joints want to be stable. You can't train everything the same. And a perfect example of this is what's happening at the hips. You know, you want mobile hips that can move freely, and you want a strong, stable core that can resist movement. And so doing things like crunches to train the core is not necessarily the best way to train that area. And but also understanding that you have to be strong and mobile with the hips in order for your core to function properly. If you simply cannot get your hips back far enough, and you're going to have to coax the movement from somewhere. And so no matter how stable your core is, your core is still going to move, because you need to create the overall movement. And so, you know, one joint affects the next. And also when it comes to injuries and stuff like that, usually the place where the pain shows up is not where the problem is. You want to check the function and stability of the joints above and below where the pain is, to see what is really happening. And again, a prime example of this is the low back. You know, a lot of times low back pain is not caused by a weak low back. It's caused by poor hip mobility, which is causing excessive movement from the low back. And so if you just try to strengthen the low back without addressing the true cause of the problem, which is the bad hip mobility, you're never going to take care of it. And so, you know, same thing with shoulders. A lot of time with shoulders, it's not shoulders that are the problem. It's your inability to control and stabilize your shoulder blade. It's that scapulothoracic joint just below the shoulders that has some dysfunction, and it's placing too much stress on the shoulders. And so, you know, that's you know, how you can use strength training to, you know, address injuries that you currently have, and also understanding how it's going to help us prevent injuries in the long run, which is huge. Because if you're hurt, it don't matter how fit you are. And so just continuing to plow head first into a performance training program while ignoring these signals that your body is sending you saying that something is wrong is just foolish, in my opinion. Again, you know, an analogy that Mike Boyle uses when talking about this joint by joint approach to training, the common approach when things start to hurt, if your low back hurts or your knee hurts or your shoulder hurts, the common approach is to pop some Advil so that it dulls the pain so that you can continue to train anyways. And the analogy he uses is like, that's like the smoke detector in your house is going off and your answer is to pull the batteries out of the thing. That doesn't take care of the fire. You know, the fire is still there. So, you know, if you find yourself having to pop some sort of painkiller on a regular basis to take care of something, you know, you need to start looking at how to address the actual problem. You know, this whole idea of just continuing to pop painkillers and then go to, you know, PT and then, you know, get surgery on it, you know, this whole pain injury surgery cycle that we're caught up in is you know, kind of insane, in my opinion. But so that's kind of the idea of how you can do that. And so, you know, real quick, just going over some key areas. The knees, If you've got knee issues, then more likely you've got some hip strength issues. And the knees are these small little joints. Your hips are these big joints surrounded by these big muscles. And if you've got knee problems, then what's happening 9 times out of 10 is you are knee dominant with your lower body movements, meaning that you try to power everything with knee extension and you don't really know how to use your hips to help power the movement. And so you're placing a lot of the stress of lower body movements on your knees and not using the big muscles in the hips to help power those movements and take some of that stress. So if you've got knee issues, you need to look at your hip strength and see if you need to get stronger with that. If you've got low back issues, then you've probably got some hip mobility issues, and something I touched on earlier where if you don't have good hip mobility, then your low back is going to have to move a lot to compensate for that. And so, again, if you've got low back pain, you need to get the hips more mobile so that the low back doesn't have to move as much in order to create movement. And then your shoulders, again, something that I addressed earlier. If you've got shoulder problems, you need to increase the mobility of the shoulder joint. You need to be able to get those shoulders back and down into a good, strong position. And you need to work on the stability of your shoulder blades. And so if you can do those two things, and then a lot of times you'll address those issues. So like rotator cuff problems, 9 times out of 10 are not weak rotator cuffs. They're overworked rotator cuffs that are being overused because of bad shoulder position and weak stabilization of the shoulder blades. And so you have to address those issues in order to really take care of any shoulder problems. So that's basically it. And again, a good performance training program is going to have these things addressed, because you're never going to be as strong with your lower body if you're a knee dominant with your movements. You have to use your hips to be as strong as possible. And again, if you, same thing with the low back. If you've got bad hip mobility and your low back is hurt, then it's going to shut everything else down. And same thing with shoulders. You'll never have the upper body strength that you could have if your shoulders are stronger and more stable. So again, a good performance training program is going to address these things and solidify these areas through these approaches, because the same things that help increase performance are also the same things that are going to help prevent and rehab injuries and stuff like that. So that's basically that with that. And so, that's kind of it. I've come to the conclusion here on my notes. A couple things I want to leave you guys with is the idea that you can't simply do more of what got you to where you're at to get to the next level. And this is where a lot of riders get stuck, because they've done some things, they've ridden their bike, and maybe they've done a little strength training or some intervals, and they've gotten to a certain level and they want to get to the next level. And you have to understand that to get to that next level, you can't simply just continue to ride your bike more and do the same program that you've been doing. You have to start looking at some of these other components on the performance wheel. You have to start looking at, the functional or the optimum performance pyramid and understanding, where your weaknesses are with that. You can't just keep doing the same things to get to the next level. And, this is, I forget where I read this saying, but, nothing fails like success on some, to a certain point. You get a rider who's had a lot of early success, and sometimes they're the hardest ones for me to work with, because they don't understand, why do I need to actually stop riding and start, as much and start working on some of these other things when, riding has gotten me to the point that I'm currently at. And, that's great if you're happy with where you're at, but if you want to get to the next level, you're going to have to do something different to get yourself there. And a lot of times for most riders, that means getting stronger, getting more mobile, and working on that anaerobic endurance, and specifically their standing pedaling endurance and stuff like that. And then lastly, just, understanding a 21st century view on performance training, that, we understand so much more about the human body today and how to get the most out of it than we did even 10, 15, 20 years ago. And so continuing to just use the same outdated traditional stuff, it's produced some results in the past, but there's better ways. So, understanding that mobility, you know, addressing, you know, some key areas like the glutes and the shoulder blade stabilizers, you know, core training, that core training is not just doing crunches and side bends, that it's actually teaching the core how to resist movement, not create movement, understanding that strength training is, you know, good functional movement, getting stronger, you know, like the just doing a deadlift, without paying any attention to how you're creating the movement is not going to get you the best transfer to the bike. Understanding how regeneration, you know, things like post-workout recovery drinks, foam rolling, getting enough sleep, and then, you know, interval training for cardio stuff, and how that, you know, how the science is showing us that that is really one of the best, most efficient ways to get fit from a cardio training standpoint. These are 21st century views on training. And, you know, again, I understand the traditionalists out there love what they have been doing, but, you know, there are better ways. I mean, shoots, at one point we thought the earth was flat, and we eventually figured out that that's not the case, and it changed everything for us. So same thing here, you know, with, when it comes to training, you know, the earth is not flat. We're finding out there's a lot more involved and much more efficient ways to achieve what we're looking for and take the body to the human body to levels that we never thought possible. So, again, it doesn't matter if you're a weekend warrior in your, you know, 50s, you know, you just started mountain biking and you're, you know, a teenager, or you're a pro racer, or, you know, somewhere in between all that stuff, you know, strength and conditioning has something to offer you. And in fact, if you're not utilizing these tactics, you're simply not going to be the best rider that you could be. And I know that, you know, not everybody's interested in winning races and stuff like that, but, you know, I personally feel like if I'm going to throw my leg over my bike, I want to have as much fun as possible. And fitter riders have more fun. I mean, period. So that's what it's all about. What it all basically boils down to is having more fun on your bike, not feeling like you're being held back by your strength and conditioning and stuff like that, and just your fitness levels, and how to improve those things in the most efficient manner possible. It doesn't take a long time, you know, 3 to 4 hours a week, and you can greatly increase your fitness levels and see huge, huge returns on the trail. So that's basically it, you know, my overview on training, where I'm currently at, kind of everything in one place here now. Once you get done listening to this, you should have a pretty good idea of my ideas on training and my philosophies and why my, you know, articles and blog posts and stuff kind of take the approach that they do. So hope everybody's found this informative, giving you some fuel for thought and some ideas for your own training and stuff like that. And once again, it's been James Wilson with MTB Strength Training Systems. Check me out on the web at bikejames.com. You'll be able to find this podcast there, along with the PDF handouts that I mentioned. And so you can take a look at those things as well. And yeah, hope you guys enjoyed it. And I'll talk to you guys next time.